On this GoldSeek.com radio Gold Nugget segment, our featured guest, Charles Hughes Smith from the Of Two Minds blog. Well, it's a pleasure to welcome Charles Hughes Smith back to the show, the author of Two Minds, an interesting website online, as well as 9 must-read books. Welcome back, Charles Hughes Smith.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
Pleasure to have you back. And, you know, so many interesting topics and topicality that I found it difficult to prepare. So I'd like to start off with an interesting topic that I think is so important to the middle class of this country, and that's the housing market. Not the hot topic that it was back in 2006, 2009, but your work seems to indicate that housing, the sector in particular here in the U.S. and in China, and we'll get to that in a minute, must be propped up to maintain the status quo.
Well, we can start by putting housing in the context of household wealth. And if we look at, you know, various charts and statistics, such as the Federal Reserve's Z1 report, we find that housing, both in the U.S. and in China, is predominantly an asset of the middle class. In other words, the top, say, 5% to 10% has quite a few financial assets, you know, stocks and bonds and 401ks and so on. But the middle class still relies very heavily on its on the private home for its wealth. We don't mean just the balance sheet of the household at this point in time, but it's also the wealth that households and families hope to pass on. And that's one measure of wealth that I think we tend to forget about. Wealth isn't just what's in your account or right now. It's what you hope to pass on to future generations.
So let's talk about how things have changed. You know, in the early 2000s, it seemed like every opportunity was available for credit in order to purchase a mortgage. And that scheme lost some momentum. But a lot of folks in the blogosphere are talking about the fact that really things haven't changed all that much. Maybe we didn't learn from the 2006 through 2009, you know, housing crisis. Take a look at, let's say, the FHA, which has just issued a huge number of loans. In other words, it's kind of led to this echo boom, as some folks are calling it. They seem loud at first, but they fade. Could we see something similar here?
I think so, Chris. And you're absolutely right in identifying the U.S. government of the echo bubble. You mentioned FHA, which has been basically tasked with replacing Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were the two quasi-government agencies that inflated the last housing bubble. And so now it's FHA, which is, again, issuing 3% down mortgages to people with sketchy credit. Not to say that this is a bad thing. What we need to differentiate is, in the old days, the private sector mortgage market was free to ascertain the risks of giving mortgages to people with poor credit or sketchy credit. And this was handled by offering them mortgages with a 20% down and a higher rate of interest. Well, now the federal government has essentially taken over the mortgage market. And last time I checked, I believe about 95% of all mortgages are backed or issued by a federal agency. So they've basically taken over the whole mortgage market. And now the only, like, sort of free market, if you will, mortgages are in the super jumbo range, which don't qualify. So what happens when the government takes over the mortgage market is, well, they can pump out a lot of low-quality, high-risk mortgages. And so history suggests that these are the ones that default early and default in a way that brings down the whole system.
In a nutshell, what you're saying is, you know, we used to have a mechanism in place that worked for decades or maybe longer, where you had a local banker who shook your hand, pressed the flesh. Folks had a better grasp of the financial wherewithal of the borrower, and that worked its way through the system, giving a more solid footing and foundation underneath the entire sector.
Absolutely, Chris. And of course, that's also being that exact same dynamic you just described is now visible in the auto industry, in the sense that the subprime auto loan industry has put out a lot of debt to for people with poor credit to buy very expensive vehicles. And so I think we can see that this deterioration of credit quality creates, just common sense tells us that it creates a heightened risk for defaults, leading to a bunch of dominoes falling as all the credit that's been piled up on this these poor risks and perhaps impaired collateral, that the whole thing tumbles down. Because, of course, if you buy a car for $25,000 or a truck, and a year later it's worth maybe $17,000 or less, depending on its condition, so the collateral has deteriorated underneath all that credit. And the same thing for housing. In the bubble areas like the left and right coasts, places with a large exposure to global capital like San Francisco, New York, Miami, Seattle, these places where foreign buyers who are rushing to get out of their weakening currencies and just get into some kind of dollar-based asset, and they're bringing cash, then that's another factor that's totally distorted the American housing market.
Well, let's stick with this theme of risk. It seems to run throughout many of your articles and much of your work. And I'd like to switch over to the paradox of risk, which you penned several years ago and then revisited it recently, what folks euphemistically call the Fed put, or this belief that the Federal Reserve will never really allow the markets to implode or retrace to the mean, okay, a more sustainable level. Now, who knows where that is? Is that 1,000 on the Dow? Is that 10,000 on the Dow? But my question for you is whether or not the system is fatally flawed and whether we should be bracing for a wake-up moment.
Yes, Chris. Well, I think wise to bring up this paradox of risk idea. And let me just briefly explain that. My analogy that I often use is the airbag in your vehicle. If you think that you're going to be saved, in other words, that risk has been eliminated because something or somebody is going to save you, no matter how much risk you take on, then it's human nature that we go ahead and accept a lot more risk because we think we're going to be saved. And so if you think that the airbag is going to save you regardless of how you drive, and so you drive 90 miles an hour in a rainstorm on slippery pavement, you're taking on way more risk than you would if you were, say, on a motorcycle with no helmet. Your risk and your behavior would be much more tightly linked, let's put it that way. So this idea that you mentioned, the Fed put, where the Federal Reserve will always save the day, so to speak, no matter how much risk has been poured into the stock market, that's kind of encouraged us all, you know, as a system, to accept way more risk than would be rational without that that so-called safety net. And so the question that we're kind of considering here is it what could happen that could cause that safety net to shred? In other words, could the market reach a point where the Fed can't save it? And then we'd be faced with the consequences of all the risk that we've collectively taken in piling all these assets into markets, especially the stock market. The risks that are piling up in the system are different than the risks that were in the economy 20 or 30 years ago. And we've identified that one of the sources of the risk is this idea that the government's going to save us no matter what happens. They'll keep the valuations at nosebleed levels through some sort of magic. And the other one is that the government has taken over the mortgage industry and basically pumped a lot of risk into the system because it's introduced a lot of people who in the past would simply not have qualified to own a house. And so those, I think that, as you say, the risk in the system is now threatening the middle class, because the middle class, the core asset of the middle class, which was the family home, has now been pushed up, if you will, into a speculative asset. And it's been loaded with so much risk that it's difficult for the market to ascertain its true value. And of course, we can look at housing like we look at anything as a business, like what's it renting for? And then we can extrapolate its value off the rent. And so by some measures, then a lot of the nation's housing is actually fairly affordable. And I'm thinking of, you know, the upper Midwest and a lot of the some areas in the South. And then there's a lot of areas where the housing is completely, you know, lost touch with reality. And so this is what I've been calling a bifurcated market. In other words, we actually have two housing markets in the U.S. So it's like how where you live in the country sort of defines how you see housing.
All right, let's move on then to another couple of interesting topics here that you cover in detail, and that's self-employment, how this metric has continued to slide for decades. And although it's somewhat cyclical, we've really seen a drop-off since the so-called recovery. Comments on the importance of the entrepreneur, as well as some of the interesting anecdotes that you provide along the way, including the former head of Intel, Andy Grove, I believe it was, in Silicon Valley. And I'd really appreciate any of your comments on COINTELPRO, a favorite topic of mine, but one we don't generally in too much detail here on the show, primarily because listeners haven't expressed demand for the topic.
Well, Chris, I think that self-employment and the middle class is a vital topic for the economic health of the nation. And back a few decades ago, never mind 100 years ago, but in the recent past, the self-employed middle class was a key part of the middle class. In other words, there was a lot of self-employed business people who owned shops and service providers and small, you know, even small manufacturing. And it's become more and more difficult to start a business, maintain a business, and make a profit in small business. And so we've seen a hollowing out of the middle class self-employed. And just in terms of just general numbers, I looked at the data, and it seems to me that there's only a few million self-employed middle-class people left. This does not count like independent professionals like doctors and attorneys who are have their own corporations. There's another 7.5 million of those. But I think the key issue is it's becoming increasingly difficult to run a business, to start a business, and to make enough money to be middle class. And so if we lose that entrepreneurial class of people who aren't trying to build the next Facebook, they simply want a good living for their family at a job that they own, then we've lost something critical. In terms of Andy Grove, of course, his book was Only the Paranoid Survive. And I find this a useful concept as a self-employed person myself. In other words, the entrepreneurial spirit requires that you're keeping an eye on competition, and that you're constantly innovating. This spirit, although you know, we focus only on the big names, Apple, Facebook, Google, and all these, you know, multi-billionaire types, really the economy is based on small entrepreneurship. You know, people trying out ideas and providing services that are scarce in their community.
I'd just be fascinated to hear any input you have on the topic.
Well, Chris, I know that it seems like a distant past to people who are young, because COINTELPRO was active in the late 60s and early 70s during the social tumult of the anti-war movement against the war in Vietnam and civil rights, other issues, environmental issues that all came up at that time. But it's what its value, I believe, is it shows how the central state, you know, in our country we call it the federal government, the central state goes to extraordinary lengths and does so in complete secrecy to suppress any dissent which is viewed as threatening to the status quo. Is sort of frightening if you learn the history of COINTELPRO, is that they really, there's really no limits. In other words, the law no longer applies. And as we've seen in these sort of anti-terrorist kind of legal movements and campaigns, you can always find a federal judge who, you know, if the laws have been basically opened up so the federal government can get away with anything, there'll be somebody who will approve it as legal, even though it's clearly illegal if you've read the U.S. Constitution. So this is what I think people, you know, have lost sight of with COINTELPRO, is that was considered an illegal campaign, right? But it was not considered illegal by the people who were doing it. They thought they were supporting, you know, the nation and doing what they were told, and that it was completely legal. So my point is, we as citizens have to decide what's legal, because the government's always going to claim whatever it's doing is legal.
Charles Hugh Smith, it's a pleasure hearing your thoughts today. Any parting comments, any topicality we've missed that you think our listeners would like?
Well, Chris, I think you're quite right to have focused a lot of our show on risk, and I would just advise people to try to make a realistic assessment of the real risk, not the risk that we're told is gone away because the Fed will always save us, but protect yourself by making a realistic assessment of the risks that you and your family do face.
Please direct people to your websites, perhaps your latest books.
Thank you, Chris. Visit me at oftwominds.com. Can check out if you know anybody that's in the job market or that needs to build a career for themselves. You can check out my recent book, Get a Job and Build a Real Career and Defy a Bewildering Economy.
There is so much excellent information here at this website. This is a must bookmark webpage, and please put it in that browser and take a look if you're struggling like millions of Americans. For instance, I just read an interesting metric last night. 50% of Americans 25 and under are living in their parents' homes, from a rare situation to a common scenario. Folks are struggling. Tens of millions have virtually given up on looking for their job of choice. Charles Hugh Smith, a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.